Let's start over again.
Mentioned in Detroit. And the opening speaker is Brother Edmund Bleachers. And he opened with the inappropriate title, Nearing the End, right at the very beginning of the convention. So we'll close this convention with the other title. Let's start over again. Have you ever read a really good book and wanted to start right back and over, go over it again? Or seen a movie you like so much, you just sat through two showings, you want to start over again? A lot of classes do this. We know a lot of classes where they study Tabernacle Shadows, and they finish it, they start over again. They just go on a regular cycle. Well, there is a study that we should do over and over again, a study that we've all just finished, and it's time to start over again. And that's a study of the Lord's life. That study we've been concentrating on the ending. The last few weeks, preparing for the memorial, we've been looking at the closing of that life. So today we're going to go back and start over again. We're going to go back and go to the beginning, not to the birth scene, not to Bethlehem, but to the early scenes of his ministry, to the very beginning of his ministry. And we're going to take, because of time, the shortest approach possible. And that's the approach of the Gospel of John. John takes highlights, and he covers the first part of Jesus' ministry in just about a chapter and a half, two chapters. He goes through it. First, what we should do is step back a little bit and get an overview of the Gospel of John so we can understand how John is coming into this. The book of John is basically divided into three sections. Chapters 1 to 3 cover the early ministry of the life of Jesus. And then chapters 4 through 10 are very strictly formatted, where he selects six incidents from Jesus' life, tells a story, and gives the sermon that Jesus gave. These six sermons are in the fourth chapter, the incident of the Samaritan woman. In the fifth chapter, you've got the Pool of Bethesda miracle. In the sixth chapter, you got the feeding of 5,000. In the seventh chapter, you got the Feast of Tabernacles. In the eighth chapter, this one is a little bit more debatable. In the King James, we have the story of the adulteress. There's much evidence that may be spurious, although we favor the thought that it is not a spurious passage. Or if spurious, there was a story of similar import that was there in the original manuscript. And then chapters 9 and 10 should be one chapter. That's incorrectly divided into two chapters. And they are based upon the story of the healing of the blind man. And the lesson of that story carries over into chapter 10. And then the third section is the last half of the book. 11 chapters. And that's the closing days of Jesus' life. John dwells on that in more detail than anyone. Starting with Lazarus raising all the way to the end. He shows cause and effect on up through the resurrection and the post-resurrection appearances. So we're looking at section 1. We're going to omit the first part of section 1, which is chapter 1, verses 1 to 28. That deals primarily, 1 through 18. That deals primarily with Jesus as the Logos, going way back. Verses 19 to 28 we're going to skip because that also precedes Jesus' ministry. 19 to 28 outline the work of John the Baptist. And our story will start in verse 29. It's the first of the eight remaining scenes that we want to look at in these opening days of Jesus' ministry. And he starts off with an interesting three words. The next day. Well, he hasn't been describing a day before then. So you don't know the next day from what. It just said the next day. I believe what he's looking at is he's seen the ministry of John, and he's bringing us right to the close of John's independent ministry before Jesus' ministry begins paralleling. And so he's bringing us right up to the time that Jesus, we believe, returns from the wilderness. And now he says the next day, and now he begins to introduce the Jesus story. The next day, John seeth Jesus coming unto him and saith, Behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. and he introduces him to his followers. And introducing him, he relates the story, probably some 40 days earlier, of the baptism of Jesus. And he said, I knew him not. Well, that's an odd statement to make. He obviously knew Jesus. It was his cousin. There obviously was communication between them. But in verse 33, he says, and I knew him not. The thought is, I knew not the specific office he was to hold. I knew not the full extent of his ministry. That too seems odd. His mother knew it. His mother prophesied it to Mary. But John did not fully recognize, evidently, at this stage, that fully he would be the one who would have a deeper ministry, a parallel ministry to John. A ministry where a baptism would be not with water, but a baptism with fire. And he said, when I was informed that the one upon whom the dove would ascend would be the one, and I saw it descend, then I knew that this was Jesus. That's all we know about this day. He just is introducing the fact that Jesus is now on the scene. That's day one. The next verse, again the next day. Now we're going to day two. This is our second scene. And in day two, John is talking with two of his disciples. He names one of them, he doesn't name the other. He says near the end of this in verse 40, one of the two which heard John speak and followed was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. We presume from the fact that he does not name the second disciple that it was John himself. That the two that were there talking was John and Andrew. And Andrew finds Peter. The selection of these three apostles was the work of the second day of Jesus' ministry. He finds them. He does not call them to be apostles. They are known as disciples of the stage. The apostling comes later. It's a totally different story. It's found in Matthew. That's when they're on a boat, and he says, leave the boat and follow me. But at this stage, he does not seek these disciples. On this day, these disciples seek him. John points to Jesus. They go to Jesus, and they say, Rabbi or teacher, where do you live? And Jesus says, come and see. And they go to his place. It's rather interesting that phrase, come and see. Where did Jesus live? Son of man hath not where to lay his head. Why, what import is there to know where he lived? I would suggest that the essence of the question is not by Jesus, come and see where I live, but come and see how I live. That it was a coming and saying, this is the lifestyle. So when I call you, if you're going to follow me, this is the lifestyle you're going to have to participate in. You're going to have to do the same as I do. You're going to have that same sacrificial giving up, that same leaving of all. And therefore, this becomes the first sign of what discipleship really means in this come and see. It was also on this day that Andrew finds Peter. And it's already that Jesus gives Peter a new name. Andrew finds his brother Simon, shouldn't say Peter. And the name that Jesus gives him, according to the Gospel of John, is not Peter. We find this in verse 42. And he brought him, Simon, to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone. We know Cephas better as Peter. Cephas and Peter are identical names. They don't sound like it to us. But they're identical names. Cephas is Aramaic. Peter is Greek. The Gospel of Matthew supposedly was written originally in the Aramaic. Aramaic was supposedly the language of the area, and it's very possibly what they talked. So Cephas was known. But what's interesting as you go through the Bible, The word Cephas is only found one other place. And it's a surprising place to find it. It is found throughout the book of Corinthians. Corinthians always calls Peter Cephas. Everybody else calls Peter, Peter, as you and I would call him. It's debatable in Galatians. There it could be, there are manuscripts both ways in Galatians. But in Corinthians, he's called Cephas. Now what's odd is Corinth is a city in Greece. Corinth is not Aramaic. And it's in Corinth that he writes and he uses the word Cephas. So the question is, why? Why use Cephas there? And I think there probably is a reason that's fairly evident from the beginning of the book of Corinthians. You remember the format of Corinth in his letter to him, and he says, you've got divisions. You've got those who say, I'm of Paul, and I'm of Cephas, and I'm of Apollos, and I'm of Christ. They didn't have a group that said, I'm of Peter. I'm of Cephas. I think it suggests that what we would call the Peter group, the Cephas group, one of their bones of contention was, you are modernizing this man. Let's go back to what Jesus called him. We are the originals. We go back to the original sources. And that's why when Paul writes to them, he says, okay, you want to call him Cephas? I'll call him Cephas. But you're still wrong. You're still wrong in making Cephas your idol. And that's why that is the only place that perhaps we find that name reappearing. Verse 43, the day following. You notice we trace the first weeks of Jesus' ministry day by day. He tells what happened day one, day two, day three. Day three, he gains two more disciples, later apostles. First, he finds Philip, and Philip finds Nathanael. And then there's that nice little episode there of the discussion between Philip and Nathanael. When Philip comes in, we found him. We found the Messiah. And Nathanael says, yeah, who is he? He's Jesus of Nazareth. Nazareth? Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And then what does Philip say? The same thing Jesus said the day before. Come and see. That expression comes in one more time. You're not going to believe it until you see it. I could tell you a thousand reasons and you wouldn't believe it. Come and see for yourself. And so he goes, and Jesus surprised him with his first words. There is an Israelite without guile. And Nathanael doesn't deny it. He said, how'd you know that? How'd you know me? Oh, I saw you praying under the fig tree. In fact, he didn't even say praying. I saw you under the fig tree. I think he was praying. I think that is the essence. But, so you see him under a fig tree. If I came up to you and said, I know you're a person without guile. I saw you under the lamppost. That wouldn't mean a whole lot to you. It evidently was the attitude that Nathanael was in at that time that was showing a searching heart, that was showing that whatever he was doing, he was seeking to know a clear understanding. And that becomes evident from Jesus' answer to him in the end of the chapter. Verses 50 and 51. And Jesus answered and said, because I said unto thee, I saw thee under the fig tree, believest thou? Thou shalt see greater things than these. And then he gives the illustration. And he said, verily, verily, I say, hereafter you shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. If I were to paraphrase this into what I think it says, I think you say, yes, I saw you praying under the fig tree. But if you think that's remarkable, in the future you're going to find prayer so clear as like a Jacob's ladder. Angels ascending and descending, prayers going up, answers coming down. You're going to see the whole pattern. Prophetically, he's looking far forward. There is a prophetic application of this at the second advent. But to Nathanael, I think the significance was, I knew what you were doing. You were there just as inquiring as Jacob was when he had his head on the pillow. Did I do the right thing? Did I do the wrong thing? and you were seeking without guile to find me. And therefore I say, I'll give you the answer my father gave Jacob. You will see angels ascending and descending. You will see that the connection is there between God and you. The difference between these 2 days, in verse 43, when telling about this day, he says, the day following, Jesus would go into Galilee and findeth Philip and said, follow me, and Philip finds Nathanael. The day before, Andrew, James, and Peter find Jesus. Here Jesus goes, and he's the initiator, and he finds Philip, and he finds Nathanael. So I think we have this little separation to show that there's 2 ways. There are those who first find the Lord, and there are those who the Lord goes out, and he first finds, and he brings. Now let's do a little counting. We found an expression that appeared 3 times in this chapter. Verse 29, the next day. Verse 36, the next day. And verse 43, the day following, or the next day. So we've got day 1, 2, and 3. Or if you want to say the first one starts the next day, you got day 1, 2, 3, 4. And the day before the day before the next day. You got 3 or 4 days, depending on how you count. Well, let's take the 3 days. That's the more logical, because that's the 3 days of his ministry. Did you ever go into a hotel and, let's say, your room is on the first floor, the elevator's over there? What do you mean? Why are you going to take the elevator to the first floor? Well, this is the ground floor. That's the first floor. You almost have to use that as if you're going to follow the next chapter, the next verse, unless you realize what the next verse is really saying. Because the next verse says, and on the third day. So if you start with day 1 here, and the next day was day 2, the next day was day 3, and on the third day, you're ready to the fourth day. So you got to say that day 0 he's introduced, and day 1, and day 2, and then on the third day. But that's wrong. Don't do that. That's what you first have to do to try to fit that in. When John 2:1 says, and on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, this does not mean day 1, day 2, and then the third day. But what this means is, you got day 1, day 2, day 3, and then the third day after that. And here's how we know that. It's very simple. A simple logistic point. He is meeting John in this passage in Bethabara, which is down near Jericho. The wedding is in Cana of Galilee, and unless you got modern transport, you're not going to get there in a day. You can't make it. It's too far. It's about 80 miles. So he's saying the third day, the 3-day journey from where this incident with these apostles is taking place. He told us already the day before he was going to go into Galilee. And so he had decided to go to Galilee. That's in verse 43. But he is delayed because he finds Philip and Andrew. And so that takes place. And now we think there's a 3-day journey. I'm going to go back to counting method number 1. The first of these days was said the next day. So if you're going to really count, you've got to start with the day that we find John's ministry ending. That's day 1, the next day, day 2, the next day, day 3, the next day, day 4. With that in mind, the third day is what day? 4 plus 3, the seventh day. Notice how often in prophecy we use that. We say the third day, oh, that's the kingdom. The seventh day, oh, that's the kingdom. Now, which is it, the third day or the seventh day? It's both days. It's the seventh day from Adam. It's the third day from Jesus. It depends where you're starting your count. This is a good illustration of that. Here, the third day is the seventh day. In context, you've got the third day following 4 days. I tend to prefer it following 3, but it's following, at least, you've got the same sequence. And it's very suggestive that what I'm going to talk about next, in your mind, start thinking Second Advent. I'm talking third day, I'm talking seventh day, I'm talking Second Advent. I'm talking something down the line. The incident in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, if I were to title that, I would call it The Reluctant Miracle. A story you know well. He didn't even plan to go to a wedding, as far as we know. He was going home to Cana. He brought his disciples with him. By the way, how many did he have at that time? He had John and Andrew and Peter. And then he picked up Philip and Nathaniel. And the other accounts indicate that when he found John, John found James, his brother. So he had six. There were six disciples that followed him. Let's store that in the back of our mind. There's Jesus and six going up to Cana. He gets to Cana, and he finds there's a wedding going on, and his mother's gone to the wedding. And in verse 2, we find that Jesus was then invited also, and the disciples. It's similar as you and I would do today. A wedding, somebody close, and you've got some extra guests that came with you. Yeah, bring them along. Bring them to the wedding too. So they come. They're sort of the last-minute invited guests to the wedding. Well, at this wedding, you recall, they ran out of wine. And his mother called to him and said, "We need wine." And he answers her with a very enigmatic statement. That is found in verse 4. "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" What disrespect it seems to be to his mother at first reading to have such a statement. Well, let's take the two problems and solve them easily. The first problem is no problem. "Woman" was a very polite statement at that time. It was "madam," "ma'am." If you travel through the south, southeast, I know a lot of the brethren there will say "ma'am," "sir," to the father and the mother. And it's a very polite frame of reference. That's no disrespect at all. "But what have I to do with thee?" That seems so odd. This concept, the statement, is not found here only. It's found nine times in the Bible. And if you go through all nine accounts where this is found, you begin to get a different feeling to the statement than we would get. For those who may be taking notes, it's found in 2 Samuel 16:10 and 2 Samuel 19:22. And in both of those cases, it's connected with the Shimei who's throwing stones at David. And David is telling his general, "I'm not getting involved in this." They won't take his head off. He said, "Well, what's that to me? What have I to do with you? Let me alone. Don't bother me with that matter." It's found in 1 Kings 17:18. I forget the exact context there. It's found in 2 Kings 3:13. And this is with the widow, with Elisha. When the child dies and Elisha comes to heal him, by now she is so upset. She's angry with Elisha. And Elisha comes to her house and says, "What have I got to do with you? Have you come to accuse me of my sins? To show me up for a sin?" And so in her case, it was an expression of anger. Then it's found in each of the Gospels, Matthew 8:29, Mark 1:24, and Luke 4:34, in the same account. And this time it's spoken by a demon, a false spirit. And this is the one who tells Jesus, "What have I to do with you? Have you come to judge me before the time?" So again, it is almost like saying, "What matter is this of yours? There's a time for my judgment. Why are you getting involved in this now?" And if you notice the reading here in John now, you'll notice he connects the same two thoughts the demons connect. "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come." Same two thoughts are there. In other words, what concern is this of mine? This is not my hour for what? For doing miracles, for displaying myself as a Messiah. He was not, at this point, thinking that that was what he should be doing. He was saying, this is not the time to do this. But she pervaded upon him. And they bring six water pots. He said, "Fill them to the brim with water." Now, he gives the size of those pots. Verse 6, they contain two or three firkins apiece. In other words, they were not all pots of the same size. Some were two firkin pots, some were three, some may have been two and a half firkin pots. Now, if my source is correct, I think it's got to be wrong. That's an awful lot of wine. A firkin, according to my source, is 6 gallons. Well, if you've got 6 pots averaging 2.5 firkins each, you've got 15 firkins, that's 90 gallons of wine. That was a real wedding. if that was, whatever the quantity was, I don't think quite that large. And there's the indication of that in the Samaritan woman in the well. She's the only other one that's got the same word for water pot, and it's something she's carrying. So it can't be quite that big. I think it's got to be a smaller firkin than we used to. What do these water pots picture? Why 6? Well, first, what is the whole scene picture? It happens on the 6th, on the 3rd day, the 7th day. Millennial picture. It's a wedding. That may or may not be important. You've certainly got an important wedding on the 7th day. You got the marriage of Christ and His church. You got another wedding on the 7th day. God remarries Israel. That takes place. But I was discussing this earlier, this convention with Brother David Rice, and I rather like the suggestion Brother David gave, and I'm going to give that. But maybe in the New Testament, a lot of the parables of Jesus about weddings are not specifically talking about the wedding, but they're talking about a symbol of a joyous occasion. And it's a more general symbol. And that sort of, to me, appeals here. That he's talking about the joys of the millennium, the joys of the kingdom, and not looking at a given specific wedding, but a festival of joy. It's like when John held up the rose. Somebody saw a love message. Well, he held up a wedding card. What's a wedding? Hey, it's a time of happiness, a time of joy. And that's a definition of wedding. It's a very fitting definition, and I think that could very well be the essence here. But you know, the wine he made was better than the wine that they had before. And isn't that really true of the contrast between the first and second Advents? The wine of the Jewish age as contrasted with the wine of the millennial age? There you've got a much richer wine. There you've got a wine that has whole, full ingredients. There you've got a wine that was prophesied in the parable of Jotham in the Old Testament, when in the parable of the trees he said, of the vine, shall I give off making grapes, whereby making wine, whereby is made glad the heart of God and man? That's an interesting phrase. Wine makes glad the heart of God and man. I like to think of the wine here as the wine of reconciliation, the concept of reconciliation, the reconciliation of God and man, that which really brings them together. But where is this wine going to be held? In water pots. In 6 water pots. Why 6? It's the church with Christ that's going to carry this wine into the kingdom. It's in the church that this wine is being manufactured. It's the whole sin offering experience. How much of the church was there present? James, John, and Peter, and Andrew, and Nathaniel, and Philip. These, I think, are the 6 water pots that he's bringing. He says, these disciples of mine are going to carry this transforming work of the water into wine. And they're 2 or 3 firkins each. In other words, they're not all going to hold 3 firkins. They're not all going to hold 2. Their capacities will differ. Just like in the final analysis, 144,000 water pots. And they're all different sizes. Some have 1 firkin, some have 6 firkins. Some have 2 firkins. Whatever size, whatever capacity you have, that's the capacity you have there. Now he said, fill it with water, and I'll turn it to wine. What is water picture? Truth. What is wine picture? Truth. So you fill it with truth and change it to truth. That doesn't make much sense at all. So you've got to then define what you mean by truth. In water we see truth in a purifying and a cleansing capacity. We see truth purging. We see truth refreshing. In wine you see truth in a spiritually revitalizing capacity where it brings to life and it makes happy the heart. And that was pretty much what they looked at as wine then. So he said, you fill it with the purifying truth now. Now let the church become purified. Let it become clean. Let it become imbued with water. And by doing that, I will give it the opportunity to give life in the kingdom. And that life will be carbonated. It'll be energized. It'll be come back rich and full, and it'll be much better than that wine which the Jews brought into the first Advent. You've got a new degree and a new extension to the wine concept that he brings in. In verse 11, he says, this beginning of miracles. You get the impression this was a miracle that Jesus didn't really choose to want to perform. He had to almost be primed into it by his mother. And then when he does get into it, he recognizes it, or at least the apostles recognize when they're writing this. This was the beginning, and this was for a purpose. And this purpose was to manifest forth his glory, and the disciples believed on him. This became the proof positive to those six disciples that were there that this was the one that they had made the choice. And so it was God's overruling of that initial start, that initial miracle that left things, carried things onward. You know, Jesus' ministry is bracketed by two unusual miracles. 95% of the miracles Jesus does are of direct physical help to somebody else. A healing. There are some exceptions, like walking on water. But most of them are very specific, feeding 5,000. But there are two that specifically stand out as being unusual in that they're not particularly healthful miracles. Making wine, I would hardly put it as a real healthful miracle. But it opened his ministry. And there's one miracle Jesus did, and I only know of one, that had absolutely did no good to anybody. It was the only miracle that stands out with being something unusual that was done that didn't really benefit anybody. The cursing of the fig tree. And that was the last miracle. His life ends with the miracle of the cursing of the fig tree and begins with the wedding. But he was laying a story of the cursing of Israel. It was a very important lesson that was there. But it was not a beneficial miracle. One more point before leaving this first miracle. It's an interesting little parallelism. What is the first marriage in the Bible? Adam and Eve. Who else? There was only one there to get married. That's your first marriage in the Bible. When did that take place? On the sixth day, as the seventh day began. So the seventh day there, you saw a marriage. Here, the sixth or seventh day on the account, you see a marriage. Jesus' ministry has a parallelism in days to the creation experience. Just as the scripture that both Brother Goodman and Brother Tabak referred to at this convention, he breathed on them and they received the Holy Spirit. That particular word breathe is only found once, the Greek word, in the New Testament. And it's only found once in the Old Testament in the Septuagint. And it's found in much the same context. God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Adam got life. Mankind got life by breath going into him. The new creation gets life by breath going into them. You find the same word in these parallel illustrations. I don't know what to draw beyond it, but it's an interesting parallelism worth mentioning and noting as we go through. Now we come down to the next incident. In verse 12 is merely a transitional scripture. After this, and you've got to read some time after this, probably about 5 months. About 4 months after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brethren disciples, and they continued there not many days, just a short time in Capernaum. Then the Jewish Passover is at hand. And that's what we know, there's got to be a few month interval here, because you've got Jesus immersed around the Feast of Tabernacles, and then you got 40 days in the wilderness, and then you've got 7 days to the wedding, and then the next incident is Passover, 6 months after he was baptized. So we've got a period of time involved here. Now we come down, and he has a cleansing of the temple. And that's always a good debate. Was this cleansing of the temple, does it belong here, or does it belong 3 years later? We had a big discussion in our class this year on that. I sided with the fact that it happened once, and I was wrong. I think I can prove almost without doubt that this happened in the first year of his ministry. There's two things in the text that I just had never noticed that pinpoint when it happened. So let's notice those to get the setting of this cleansing of the temple. In verse 20, Jesus had said in verse 19, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, wilt thou rear it up in 3 days?" Now, history records the temple never got finished. When Titus' army comes in and destroys it, it still hadn't been completed. It was still under construction. So he's not saying it took 46 years to build it. It's been 46 years in building. So we can pinpoint when the temple began. Then we can pinpoint when this Passover was. It's a simple mathematical calculation. Josephus tells us that it began in 20 B.C. But Josephus obviously does not write. The temple was built in 20 B.C. It's like finding a coin saying 300 B.C. You can't find such a coin because they didn't know how many years it was until C came. So you have to say that what he did was give it in the year of Herod's reign. And Herod's reign, by tradition, ends in 4 B.C. That tradition has held for years until about the last 8 or 10 years, when more and more evidence has come to show that no, Herod's reign ended in the 0 year, the 1 A.D. year, right at the turn of the B.C. A.D., 4 years later. So now change Josephus. He's not saying 20 B.C., he's saying 16 B.C. 46 years this has been. 16 B.C. brings you to 30 A.D., the beginning of Jesus' ministry. It pinpoints you within the context what year he's pointing to. Secondly, you come down to verse 23. Still in the same story. "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day, many believed." In 33 A.D., where was Jesus on the feast day? In the grave. He wasn't in Jerusalem. That verse would not apply in 33, but it will apply 30, 31, 32. Any of these years it would fit, but it would not apply in 33. So for these reasons, we think it's quite definite in our minds that it must have been in the first year of Jesus' ministry, 6 months after he began his ministry. You have this cleansing of the temple. You have it again in the scenes of Passover, very definitely. So there are two cleansing minimum. There could be some brethren feel there are four every year he did it. That's highly debatable. There's no evidence for four. It's a plausible theory, but not in evidence. Why does he do it these two times? Well, the latter appears to be very obvious. He does it to show his authority. He's coming in as king. He takes his authority in the Father's house. He drives out the money changers. But why would he do it here, at the very beginning of his ministry? And are there any uniquenesses about the way he did it here? Well, we think that he did it here because he is showing exactly what the verse says he's showing. Verse 17, "The zeal of thine house hath eaten me up." He's showing, "I am showing my love for the law and all it is, and my zeal for your temple has consumed me, and I am using my prerogative as a righteous Israelite to cleanse the temple of Lebanon." He's showing a pattern. He doesn't need to show it to the end when he shows it as a sign of authority. There are two things that are unique in this cleansing that are not in the other cleansing. In this cleansing, it tells what he used to drive the money changers out. A scourge of cords. You don't find that in the other case. There he overturned the tables. In this case, he drives the animals out. In the other case, nothing is mentioned about driving the animals out. He merely overturns the tables. So you have quite a difference in the two records. This one was the more thorough of the cleansing in many ways. And I think it's fitting that this is the one where you find the scourge, because it tells how you make a scourge. The word made here is he plaited a scourge, or in other words, braided. He took small cords and braided them together to give more strength to the cords. This word for cords here only appears one other place, and it's used of big cords. chords that hold a ship in Acts 27. So here it's small chords. We like the concept that is given in the volumes regarding the scourge of small chords, that it was the effect of the combination of principles and doctrines. He is bringing together the principles of the law, and he's showing these principles united, weave together, drive out the concept of mercantilism, making merchandise within the temple. In driving out the animals, he mentions all the animals going out, but he singles one animal out separate from the others. And I think for a purpose. He mentions the driving out of the oxen and the bulls and everything, and he drove the doves. He picks up the doves in the latter account also. He doesn't drive them out there. He tells the keeper, get them out of here. He tells them to take them away. But here, the doves are dripping out. There's a lesson in emphasizing the doves. In your sacrifice of the law, the people were to offer what was suitable to their economic condition. Those that had more were to offer a bullock. Those that had less were to offer a goat. And the poorest were to offer a dove. The dove was the offering of the poorest. Now, do you remember sometime later when John is in prison and he sends the disciples to Jesus and said, are you the one who's to come, or should we look for another? Do you remember the six evidences Jesus gave? There are six evidences, six miracles he calls attention to. And usually when you got a list, you build. Either you start with your primary, or you start with your minor and you build to the major. And he talks about the blind see, the deaf hear, the lepers are cleansed, the lame man walks. Then he gets to the big one, and the dead are raised. What's the big one? What's the final one? And the poor have the gospel preached to them. That was his greatest miracle. That was the end of the list. The poor had the gospel preached to them. That's who was being exploited in the temple. It was the poor, and the doves were the animal of the poor. And so as a result, he is showing right from the beginning, my interest is in the poor. My interest is in those who are at the bottom of the rung, and therefore he drives out the changers. My time's up, isn't it? Oh, I have to do this? Okay. I thought it was over three. Okay. Not saved by the bell yet. We'll pass on to the next story, which is verses 13. No, we just had that one. Chapter 3. We're going to skip the next story. It's a long one. It's the Nicodemus episode and its function here. We'll just mention its overall function without getting into the details. Here he begins introducing the high calling concepts. Here's where he introduces what spirit begetto is. This part of the ministry now, he's going out of dealing with Israel as Israel, but dealing with those who want to know what one must really do to inherit life. And he goes through the aspects of being born of the Spirit and begotten of the Spirit and all the aspects there. We're going to pass on to the last of the early scenes. Chapter 3, verses 22 to 36. And this is the baptisms of Jesus and John. Chapter 3, starting in verse 22. After these things came Jesus and his disciples into the land of Judea, and there he tarried with them and baptized. Now John also was baptizing in Enon, near to Salem, because there was much water there, and they came and were baptized. John was not yet cast into prison. And there rose a question between some of the Jews' disciples, John's disciples, and the Jews. And here I might say there is ambiguity in the original text. Some texts read Jews, others read, and those of Jesus, the followers of Jesus, and that certainly fits the context better, because that is what he's talking about, a dispute between John's disciples and Jesus' disciples, not the Jews in general, about purifying. And they came unto John and said, Rabbi, he that was with thee beyond Jordan, to whom thou bearest witness, behold, the same baptized, and all men came to him. We'll stop the reading there. We like to notice several factors in these two baptisms. When Jesus is baptized of John, He's baptized in the Jordan River at Bethabara. It's very obvious. It's given, the location is given. Now it says John has moved his site to Enon near Salem because there's much water there. Well, Enon near Salem is on what's called today the Wadi Parah. It's a stream that is seasonal, and it flows down from near Shechem in the Samaritan Highlands, entering the Jordan at the city of Adam. That's where it comes in. It's a feeder. If that feeder had not a lot of water, then Jordan had a lot of water. You can't have Jordan low in water and the feeder high in water, because the feeder is coming into the Jordan. So the reason cannot be only because there's much water there. There's also much water in Jordan. Of course, it could be because then Jordan had too much water. It was in flood time. And that is evidence from Judges 2:15, where it says that in the harvest time, Jordan overflowed its banks. This was the normal pattern of the Jordan River. But I think these two rivers are interesting. John is from Hebron. Hebron is quite a bit south of Jerusalem. Jesus is from Galilee, and that's way north. Neither of them are near the Jordan River. Why does John choose the Jordan to baptize? Well, the first obvious answer is, it's the big river. It's the famous river, and it's the one everybody knows about. And it's close to Jerusalem, where most of his candidates would come from. That's possible. That's very possible. However, the only candidates we know of by name were not Judeans. All the candidates we know of were Galileans. These are the ones that were particularly around him, and he's way down south with these Galileans that he's baptizing. And it's out of his Galilean contingency that Jesus' disciples come. We tend to think it's because the Lord overruled is part of the picture. The word Jordan means judge down. That's what John's baptism was all about. John's baptism was under the law, and it was a cleansing from judging down. Now he moves it to Enon near Salem, to the waters that flow into the Jordan at the city of Adam. The city of Adam is an important city historically and geologically in Israel. When Israel entered the promised land under Joshua, remember how they entered dry shod? Because the waters were backed up from Adam onward. That was where the great landslide is that opened the water for them to cross over. Beautiful picture of another Adam. The waters of the death sentence are backed up all the way to the Adamic sentence, all the way back to Adam. And here he's now connecting, in advance of John's baptism, a purifying from Adamic sin. Not only from the law sin, but from Adamic as well. Well, Jesus is baptized. Now, when he said Jesus is baptizing, the fourth chapter makes it clear. He doesn't mean Jesus, the individual. He means those who are of Jesus. His disciples are baptizing. Because it says in 4, I think verse 1, Jesus baptized not, but his disciples did the baptizing. So it was not Jesus personally who did it. Was Jesus' baptism the same as John's? Was he also baptizing for repentance of sins? And that is a question that's hard to answer. Our hearts say no. Our hearts say, obviously, no, this is a new ball game. Jesus is introducing something entirely different. And I think this supports that. It supports two things. First, it supports a question that I've had for many years. Where did the concept of baptism come from anyway? You don't find it in the Old Testament. It just brings on the scene. Well, notice what the question was. It was a question about purifying. They were considering baptism a matter concerning purifying. Anyone who's been to Qumran, the Essene monastery, sees a sample of what had come to be known in the Essene community as the baptismal pools. These were pools where they would have ritual baths. It was a ritual purifying. And I think this is the concept we're finding here. Jesus' baptism was not a baptism for purifying. That's what John's was, and they were assuming the same with Jesus. And that's why John is saying, I must decrease and he must increase. My baptism must decrease. Those that I am concerned with will be lesser, and those that will go into this will be greater. That's why Jesus said on one occasion, the law was preached unto John. But since then the gospel is preached, and all men flock into it. It becomes the receptacle of the larger point. Now this purifying, you carry it back to the Old Testament. You get back to the tabernacle and ritual washings there. And there it's interesting that in the ritual washing of the tabernacle, the Levites in Numbers 8 washed their clothes, but the priests washed their flesh. Here was a baptism now of the priesthood that he's introducing, a different thing that is not a cleansing of sins of the past, but an anointing of priesthood of the future, a looking forward to a different aspect.